In his new biography of Utah Senator Mitt Romney, which just came out last week, the journalist McKay Coppins reveals this uncanny parallel between the political fortunes of the senator and his father, George, who had been a successful governor on the ascendancy, like his son, and yet had paid what Coppins describes as a tragic price for his ideals. Coppins told us Governor George Romney planted himself squarely in the liberal wing of the Republican Party. He talked about civil rights and housing and education, and he was worried about the growing right wing of the party, the John Birchers and the conspiracy theorists and segregationists. George Romney was determined to hold the line against them.
Barry Goldwater, who is a radical right-wing senator from Arizona and an opponent of the Civil Rights Act, actually won the Republican presidential nomination in 1964. And he was leading this conservative movement that George found distasteful, vulgar, outrageous in many ways. So when the Republican National Convention took place in San Francisco in the summer of 1964, George Romney actually went there to oppose this right-wing insurrection that he considered taking place in his party. And as he walked around the venue that week, he saw for the first time that his party was being taken over by these elements that he didn't recognize. There were these unruly conservative activists who were booing and hissing and in fact, even drew some comparisons in the press to a Nazi rally. George recognized pretty quickly that he didn't fit there.
Mr. Chairman, I yield 10 minutes to speak in support of this amendment to the governor of the great state of Michigan, the Honorable George Romney.
When it came his turn to speak at the convention,
thank you very much.
He delivered this kind of famous indictment of the new right-wing movement.
The present basic trends and perils are rushing us toward a national crisis.
Barry Goldwater, he refused to endorse him. He said that the GOP must not succumb to extremism and lily-white Protestantism.
And had Lincoln ignored the know-nothing extremists of his day, he would not have been president of the United States and saved the nation.
He saw himself as a bulwark against the right-wing extremism that was taking over his party in the 60s.
When it comes to this, and these are still Lincoln's words, when it comes to this...
I hadn't realized this, but Mitt Romney actually attended that convention in 1964 with his dad. He had a little associate delegate badge hanging around his neck, and he walked around with his dad and also saw how outnumbered his dad and his brand of Republicanism was. But what's interesting is he saw his dad as the clear hero of this story. On the final night of the convention, Barry Goldwater stood up to accept the nomination and gave a speech that was basically a direct response to the George Romney wing of the party.
And let our Republicanism, so focused and so dedicated, not be made fuzzy and futile by unthinking and stupid labels.
His famous quote from that speech was, "Extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice."
And let me remind you also that moderation in the pursuit of justice is no virtue.
The convention hall erupted in applause. Mitt looked over and saw his dad quietly sitting, watching it all happen. And Mitt's takeaway from all of that was, if thousands of people were cheering and dad was standing alone, I knew he was right and they were wrong.
How much does this particular story and his father's story influence Romney's perspective now? Because it's complicated. The lesson doesn't just seem to be stand up against the forces of extremism. You also say in the book that there's a cautionary tale in that story from Mitt Romney, that his father was brought down as a political leader by his most admirable quality, this insistence on telling the truth. So there's two lessons, I guess, here in this story.
I think for most of Mitt's political career, the lesson he took from the story of George Romney was to be careful, to not challenge the orthodoxies of your party, to meet the voters in your party where they are, to not be reckless, to not veer from talking points. He basically saw his dad's story as a cautionary tale and did everything he could when he went on to try to become president to define his approach to politics in contrast to his dad's. It really wasn't until this last 7 or 8 years that he took a different lesson from his dad's story, which is sometimes it's okay to be the one person sitting down quietly while everyone around you is cheering.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, McKay Coppins is taking us through his new book, the result of some 45 interviews conducted over 2 years. Coppins says Romney could be judgmental, puckish, halting. He would confess to his own compromises, then walk it back, get angry, then cool down. Clearly, he was a man reckoning with the costs of a claim in power. Coppins says he approached Romney in the days after the riots of January 6th to make his pitch.
I had profiled him for The Atlantic. I had obviously covered his presidential campaign, so I knew him a little bit, and I had been talking to him throughout the 2020 election, the pandemic, just kind of checking in from time to time, seeing how he was doing, seeing if there was, you know, any news that he wanted to share with me. After January 6th, I could sense that something was going on with Romney. Like, he was really shaken by what had happened at the Capitol. He was contemplating what his party had become, what was happening to the country. He was talking in kind of sober and frightened ways about the fragility of American democracy. And he was also, at least it seemed to me, in an introspective soul-searching mood, which as a, you know, prospective biographer is exactly where you want your subject to be, right? Mm. I mean, so I went to him probably a couple months after January 6th. I remember our first meeting was in his Senate hideaway, which is like a small windowless room near the chamber. Each senator gets one where you kind of go to have meetings or rest during late night votes. And we were in that room. And I remember there was still barbed wire fencing up around the Capitol as a holdover from the January 6th riots. And I met with him and my pitch was this. I think you're in a really interesting place right now. I think you're in an interesting headspace. And I think you have an amazing story to tell. Mm. You've been inside of Republican politics for 30 years. You've seen a lot. You've seen your party change. And I want to write a biography where you tell me the story of your life, your career, and this transformation of the Republican Party over the last 10 years. But I said to him, I only want to do this if you're completely ready to be candid. Yeah. Like, you need to tell all the stories. And to my surprise, he kind of took it as a challenge.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
He immediately told his scheduler, no, we're going to block off weekly interviews. McKay can ask whatever he wants. No subject is off limits. Mm. And so he made clear right from the beginning that he was ready to take this seriously, right? Like, he was acting in good faith. He was ready to talk and have difficult conversations. And a lot of the conversations were difficult. You know, I was convinced from the beginning that he was being honest with me. But I think there were moments where he was still trying to be honest with himself. Mm. And that's what a lot of our conversations kind of revolved around.
The questions that you were wanting to get at here, did you think of it as a kind of a conventional biography at first? Let's go through the story of his life. Or it seems like in some ways you were also more interested in this particular moment, you know, as much as Romney himself. Like, what had changed in American political culture? Why it had changed? Like, did the idea start to evolve as you had these conversations, because then it becomes an actual reckoning, you know, as in the title.
I was interested in his story as a lens through which we could see this moment,
right?
And because he was an unusually honest and candid subject, I had a sense or a suspicion that he might be a kind of uncommonly reliable guide, right? because there are a lot of unreliable narrators right now in American politics. I got the sense that he was not one of them. And so I wanted to look at how the Republican Party had changed, how the country had changed, and how we had gotten to this moment where it really does feel like our constitutional system, our democracy, the American project is under threat. And Romney, I think part of the reason he decided to do this with me is because he feels the same way and he wanted to kind of issue a warning of some kind. You know, he had seen a lot inside of politics, and especially the last several years in the Senate. He had seen hypocrisy, he had seen cynicism, he had seen all the little, you know, calculations and rationalizations and compromises that people make, and how those things can pile up to enable demagoguery and extremism, even authoritarianism. And he wanted to warn people. And I think that that was one of the main things that drove him to talk to me.
Which sort of gets us to the title of the book, because you say early on that you had never, this is how you put it, you had never encountered a politician so openly reckoning with the cost of political power. I guess it's about that cost, right?
Mm-hmm. It's about the compromises that you make to get political power, right? And Mitt, to his credit, was incredibly introspective about the compromises he had made. So when he speaks to groups of students or young people and they ask him for his advice, one of the first things he says to them is, don't sacrifice your principles at the altar of ambition. And what he says is, it's not worth it, believe me. And there were many times throughout our interviews where he would look back at decisions he made when he was trying to win an election and say, I wouldn't do that now. And I wish I hadn't done that. And it wasn't worth it, right? And his journals are a fascinating document because they're kind of filled with these introspective entries where he's trying to weigh the pros and cons of taking a certain position or maybe crossing a certain line. And he struggles with it. You know, one of the things I realized about him, and this was actually pretty late in the process, was that he has a fully functioning and frankly sort of inconvenient and pushy conscience, right?
Yeah.
He is constantly, everything that he does, he has to get right with his conscience. He has to convince himself that it's the right thing to do, right? And that's why he has this kind of tendency to rationalize at times. And at first, I assumed that he was basically bracketing questions of right and wrong for certain portions of his career. But the point he made to me was, no, if I was bracketing questions of right and wrong, I wouldn't need to rationalize. I would just do whatever I needed to do to win. But because I was always thinking about it, the rationalization was necessary because it's how I kind of talked myself into doing things that I otherwise wouldn't do.
You know, it's so interesting. You mentioned how there was something almost, this is how you put it, alchemical that happened to Romney when he got in front of crowds in political races. Like the NRA, he said, how it makes you, as he told you, say the things that make the audiences respond positively. So he's sort of drawn into that allure. And you say that this, it was around this time when this is when he's being taken in by the crowds that this new persona starts to form. And you write that when this was working for him politically, and these are your words, he did not pause to consider whether the political this political reinvention was more or less authentic to who he truly was, which is, I guess he thinks about that now, but at the time he didn't, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's interesting because he thought when he, especially in those early races, when he was running for governor, especially when he ran for president the first time, he had this kind of quaint notion that running for president could be about the things he cared about, right? He cared about deficit reduction and job creation and, you know, fiscal issues. And he said, you know, that's what I'm going to focus my campaign on. But when he got in front of those crowds, he realized fairly quickly that right-wing crowds in presidential primaries don't want to hear about your, you know, 59-point plan to fix the economy. They want to hear you talk about guns and killing terrorists and the evils of abortion. And he found himself saying things on those stages that he didn't fully agree with, or he wasn't sure he fully agreed with. But I think that something that you have to understand about him is that he really is not an ideological person. When he would have debates with his staff about a given policy issue, he would often wind up kind of arguing against himself. And what that shows to me is that he basically believes that there are reasonable positions to take on any number of issues. And so what he basically would tell himself is, well, look, if this position helps me get a little closer to the White House than this other position, and they're both reasonable, I'm going to take the one that helps me, right? And I kind of understand that, but I think over time, what it meant was that he kind of lost a little bit of himself and instead created this persona that was calibrated to those conservative crowds and not really calibrated to the things he cared most and the positions that he really wanted to take.
Let's back up and talk about his early life that you spend some time with in the book. You say that as a kid, he didn't really necessarily know or understand he was rich. I mean, I'm sure he had some sense of it, but you say that he carried himself with a kind of rich kid carelessness. What does that mean? Like, was he a good guy? Could he be a jerk? You know, I mean, that this comes up in the 2012 election when he's running for president, that he could be a bully and cruel. But what do we know about his early life that says something about who he is?
Well, so he grew up obviously in a rich family, but he also grew up in a place where all of his neighbors were rich. And, you know, he was not, by his own account, a very serious person when he was a kid and a teenager. He liked to pull pranks on people. You know, he liked to blast Ooga horns during slow dances or fill dorm rooms with shaving cream. So he was kind of, you know, like a sort of merry prankster. And I think he carried himself in a way that, you know, he knew he wouldn't ever get in real trouble. You know, his dad was the governor of Michigan, he was insulated by money and privilege and power, and he was a young white man in suburban Detroit. And even if it was just intuitively knew he wasn't really ever going to have consequences for his actions. And yes, there were, you know, the way he described it to me is that he was not very athletic. He was not good at sports. And so he tried to compensate for that by being kind of this, the class clown. He got decent grades, not great grades. He had a lot of girlfriends. But there were some people who knew him back then who have since said that he had a mean streak. He did admit to me that there were times when he could, you know, he was capable of adolescent cruelty. He recalled once laughing at a kid with a cleft palate who blessed the sacrament at church and seeing the kind of humiliation in the kid's face. There was another time where he pulled a chair out from a kid who fell down and everybody laughed at him and the kid cried. And interestingly, those moments actually still are with him. And he finds himself kind of wondering how many other people he might have hurt in what he thought was sort of harmless pranks as a kid.
Let's talk about his faith. And I guess we should start with his wife, Anne, who, when they met, was Episcopalian. And you write about this story when their first date or one of their first dates, when she asks him, what do Mormons believe? Which he wasn't expecting or hoping to sort of elaborate on his – we'll talk about what he felt at the time about his own faith, because there was a – there seemed to be a kind of sort of ambivalence about it, but we'll get back to that. But it does lead to this conversation about the nature of God, and what does it – and she – of course, as we know now, she ultimately ends up being baptized. So what does this say about his story, I guess?
I think that speaks to the fact that as a young man, he really didn't take his faith super seriously. He wasn't, you know, a partier by any stretch. You know, he told me he drank alcohol one time and got sick and kind of swore it off after that. So it's not that he was, you know, this crazy rebel, but he didn't really think or care that much about his faith or the church. You know, he was expected to serve a mission like his father had. But when he was getting ready to graduate high school, he told Anne that he wanted to marry her when she graduated. She was a couple years younger than him, and actually floated the idea of just skipping his mission so they could start their lives together earlier. And Anne, who was not a member of his faith at that point, but sensed in some way that his faith was more important to him than even he realized, told him, you can't do that. You'll resent me for the rest of your life if you don't go on your mission. And so she was the one, non-Mormon, you know, Episcopalian girlfriend, who pushed him onto a mission because she had this sense that he would regret it if he didn't go.
Yeah, it's you say that before his mission, that he thought of his faith as just kind of an interesting heirloom. That it was part of his heritage. You know, the Romneys had this deep heritage with Mormonism, but it was his mission that gave him this deeper connection with it. This is – it gained texture, I think is how you put it. So let's talk about his mission, because you tell the story – so he serves in this working-class city in France. It's grueling. The people are incredibly hostile to, you know, to Americans, to Mormon missionaries. He has this chronic case of diarrhea, and it starts to feel kind of pointless to him. But then you write about this moment. It's kind of – I guess it could be kind of an epiphany when he reads about an early Mormon leader named Parley P. Pratt. Talk about this moment for Mitt Romney.
Well, his parents had sent him the autobiography of Parley P. Pratt, right, who was – actually related to his family on his father's side. But, you know, Pratt was one of Mormonism's kind of legendary early missionaries, baptized hundreds of people. He was sort of a well-known figure in the faith. And his book was widely read in the church. Mitt was reading it after months of grueling, you know, door knocking. He would go into these concrete towers and go door to door and try to get people to talk to him. And he told me they would go months without anybody inviting them in to talk. And so he was really just depressed and sick and fed up and feeling like he was wasting his time. And he was reading the book one night in his room, and he came across this story about Parley P. Pratt as a missionary in New York City who had gone through months without converting anybody. And, you know, Mitt obviously felt like something about that story resonated to him. And then one day, Parley P. Pratt kneeled down to pray with his companions and received this miraculous vision where the Lord said that he had, I'm quoting from the book, the Lord said that he had heard our prayers, beheld our labors, diligence, and long-suffering towards that city, and that he had seen our tears. Our prayers were heard and our labors and sacrifices were accepted. And for Mitt, it was a clarifying moment. You know, he didn't have any kind of vision, but there was something about the idea that maybe doing the hard thing was the point, right? Making the sacrifice was the point. Whether it, you know, led to converts, whether it yielded any fruit at all, the deprivation and the difficulty had their own sanctifying effect, and that was reason enough to stay on his mission and keep going.
Right up front in the book, you mention this. I think it relates, obviously, to this experience he has where he gets – there's an accident. The wife of the mission president is killed in this accident. People – that story was, related a lot during the 2012 election when he ran for president. But you mentioned right up front in the book how for most of his life he's nursed this – morbid fascination with his own death. Part of it is from that accident, but you say that he never has really, Romney, never really interrogated the cause of that preoccupation about death. How do you understand that now?
I think there's a lot going on there, honestly. I mean, there's one way to read this or to kind of interpret his fixation on his own death as like almost like a post-traumatic stress response to that accident, that, you know, near-death experience of his youth. But there's also the fact that he thinks about his kind of legacy, and he thinks about like what he has accomplished with his life. Mm-hmm. And it's part of the reason that he was kind of in such a hurry as a young man, right? He gets back from his mission, immediately marries Anne, and decides, I need to take my life seriously, right? After that accident, he had this sense that he didn't know how long he'd be on the earth, but he wanted to, you know, make a dent somehow. And so he graduates from BYU, he goes to Harvard, studies both law and business, gets a JD MBA, and he's, you know, like working harder than any of the other students at Harvard. He's studying all night. He gets a job as a management consultant, and he's, you know, putting in long hours. He just has this kind of drive, and I think it is tangled up with his very acute sense of his own mortality.
Mm. Let's talk about the interviews. Something like 40 of them, all told, I guess. Many of them happened at Romney's townhome in Washington, D.C. And you've talked a little bit about like getting there and sort of digging into the refrigerator. He said, get yourself a drink and like settling in. And you talk about, you say in the book, some nights he would vent, sometimes he would dish. And you say that his attempts to sort of process all of this could be halting, could be messy. Sometimes he would confess, sometimes he would walk it back, sometimes he'd get, sounds like, pissed off, and then he would cool. Like, what was your relationship like? What were those conversations like? And did he ever wonder, like, oh, I've made a mistake. This guy wants nothing but dirt. Like, what was it like?
Yeah, it's a good question. I often found myself wondering what he thought, you know, how this was all going from his end of the living room, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Because, I mean, week after week I would come and I would, you know, ask these questions about what he was seeing inside these caucus rooms, or I'd ask difficult questions about his life and career. And sometimes they were, you know, I would challenge him a little bit. I would push back. There were moments where it was slightly adversarial, not in a mean-spirited way, but I was trying to get, you know, pull out the full truth from him, right? Mm-hmm. But a lot of the time it was also just, you know, fun. I got the sense that he kind of liked the company. He really was sort of a lonely, isolated guy in Washington. He didn't have a lot of friends in his own party. He wasn't one of these senators who goes out at night to kind of hobnob and attend all the functions and get your picture taken at some gala. Like, he had no interest in that. He would do his work and often work late hours, but then he would go back to his townhome and eat dinner by himself on a recliner in front of the TV. So when I would show up, I think he was relieved to have somebody to talk to, frankly. But, you know, like, there were many times, especially early in the process, where I kept waiting for him to kind of throw me out or put an end to this, you know?
Yeah.
But every week I would get another text from his scheduler and say, you know, the senator has Wednesday at 7 p.m. open. Does that work? And I'd say, sure. And I'd show up and he'd welcome me in and give me a seltzer. And again, I think he deserves credit for that. I think, like, that even when the conversations got difficult, and even when I'm sure it wasn't always fun for him, he continued to sort of do the hard work of going over his life, reassessing the decisions he had made in his career, and grappling with the hard questions about his party. And I was grateful that he was willing to do that.
What difference did it make that you are a fellow Latter-day Saint? And I don't just mean that maybe he granted you access to his life in a way he might not somebody else, because as you sort of mentioned toward the end of a book, that he said you sort of get the Mormon thing is how he put it. I don't necessarily mean that, but maybe that was a factor. But I just wonder what impact the fact that you yourself are a Latter-day Saint, how did that have on the way you were thinking about this story, if it did, and processing it with him, I suppose?
Well, you know, it's funny. I had covered his presidential campaign in 2012, and I was the only Mormon reporter on the traveling press bus, right?
And he didn't give you an interview.
He never talked.
He's
had a whole year.
Yeah.
You know, it was a different time for him, right?
Sure.
His religion was a liability, politically speaking. Republican primary voters didn't like the fact that he was Mormon. A lot of, you know, secular liberal voters didn't like the fact that he was Mormon. And his campaign consultants had basically made a strategic decision to not talk about the Mormon thing in their words, right? And so then there's this Mormon reporter on the back of the bus who's writing all these inconvenient stories about how he was shaped by his faith and how his faith intersects with his politics. And so they kept me at arm's length. When we started the process of writing this book, though, Mitt said, you know, upon reflection, I think that it's an advantage that you get the Mormon thing.
Mm.
And I didn't know totally what he meant at that point, but I think over the course of our conversations, you know, one thing was just helpful is that we could use a shorthand with each other that he wouldn't have been able to use with another writer. You know, he could explain something that happened on his mission without having to step back and give a 5-minute explanation of how, you know, Latter-day Saint missions work. Or he could, you know, talk about his frustration with certain elements of, elements of Utah and how Trump is, taken over part of the Republican Party in Utah. And he kind of knew that we both had a background in the testy relationship between Mormon conservatism and Trumpism, right? I think there was just that mutual understanding certainly helped. But then there was another thing, which I don't think I understood how helpful it would be until well into the process. But the fact that we both grew up Latter-day Saints in places where there were not many members of our faith, I think helped us understand each other. You know, he obviously grew up in Michigan. I grew up in Massachusetts. We both had a lifetime of experiences of being the only Mormon in the room or in the party or on the team or whatever. And, you know, something he said to me once was that growing up a member of our faith in places where there aren't a lot of members of our faith makes it so that you get used to being different in ways that are important to you. And I think I intuitively understood what he meant in a way that I hope informs the book.
I want to ask you about what Romney's political aspirations meant and say about his personal ethics, because this first comes up in his first political race against Senator Ted Kennedy in Massachusetts. And there's this master's thesis that you write about, George Romney in 1968, from front runner to dropout. And I'm not sure if it was in this particular race, but everyone on the team, its political team, gets this copy. And you write about how they would lay out the weaknesses of his father's campaign in 68, like financial problems, and there was some organizational dysfunction, and he was unwilling to have, as you say, friendly drinks with reporters. And so he would study these weaknesses. And you talk about how the campaign in some way was sort of defined in contrast to his father's. What's going on there?
You know, Mitt had watched his dad's presidential campaign melt down while he was a Mormon missionary in France. So Mitt wasn't, you know, fully immersed in the campaign. He didn't understand all the political dynamics at play. But what he did see happen was his dad give an interview late in his campaign about why he had changed his position on the Vietnam War. Mm-hmm. And in the course of that interview, George, and this is kind of a famous moment, said that, you know, when he had gone over to Vietnam, he had been brainwashed by the generals into supporting the war effort. And, you know, what George was trying to say was that he had been sold a bill of goods, basically, and that the, you know, military was misleading Americans about what was going on in Vietnam. But it was that word brainwashing that sort of went, you know, viral for the 1960s, right? It was in political cartoons. It was in editorials. It was on TV. The, you know, Republican leaders condemned him, and it sort of sent his campaign spiraling. And so the lesson that Mitt took was, I need to be extremely careful, right? I'm never going to let a gaffe like that derail my presidential campaign. But there was another, I think, bigger lesson even that Mitt took from this, which was that his dad's failed candidacy for president was sort of rooted in George trying to fight the tides of his party, right? In 1968, this is right around the time that conservatives and white Southerners are taking over the party. Richard Nixon realized that and deployed what was called the Southern Strategy, where he leaned into law and order and white grievance and built this coalition of voters who were essentially motivated by backlash to the civil rights era. And George went the opposite direction. He ran his campaign by touring American inner cities and posing with, you know, black civil rights leaders and pictures. And Mitt, you know, I think whether it was consciously or subconsciously, sort of realized, like, that's not how you get to the presidency, right? And so when he was running in 2008, he sort of said, like, we're not going to do quixotic tours of American ghettos. We're not going to go on righteous crusades to change hearts and minds. And we're not going to wage this kind of epic, important battle for the soul of our party. We're just going to follow the data. We're going to follow the polls. We're going to develop a strategy and we're going to stick to it. He really approached it like a management consultant. And it got him pretty close to the White House ultimately. But I think it was actually kind of the biggest hindrance to him winning, because on some level, voters were always suspicious that he didn't mean what he said, that he wasn't really being his authentic self.
I think what's interesting, too, is you write about the difference between his sort of strategy or his thoughts about running in 2008, when he, you know, doesn't make it past the primaries, to 2010 as he's thinking about running in 2012 as president again. And you write about the fact that he has second thoughts about running. And the party, in the same way, I suppose, that his father was seeing, was changing. Huge swaths of their party had you know, become radical in his mind. And Romney, you say, sensed this shift, and he's having second thoughts. And so he writes this email I wanted to ask you about in 2010 that he wanted his campaign to be, here's how he put it, far less concerned about what people think or even whether my message is popular or not. He wants to be, what, true to himself. What's going on here? Talk about this moment.
Well, so this is between his first run for president in 2008 and his second in 2012.
Right.
At that moment, like you said, the Tea Party is coming to power. People like Glenn Beck are becoming central voices on the right. And, you know, conspiracy theory culture is becoming a more important element of conservatism. And you know, a lot of this is shaped by backlash to having a black liberal president in the Oval Office, right? And so in the midst of all this, Mitt Romney is kind of looking at the political climate and wondering whether he can really run again and win the Republican nomination, given how things are.
Yeah.
And he writes this email to one of his advisors and says, look, if I'm going to do this again, I want to be more true to myself. And it's not about my reputation, because that's about what other people think of me. It's about integrity, right? I want to feel like I can maintain my integrity while I run. And the way that he ultimately sort of talked himself into believing that he could win the Republican nomination while holding on to his integrity was by convincing himself that this new right-wing populist movement that was taking over the party, the Tea Party, was ultimately about, and this is, I laugh because it's kind of quaint in retrospect.
About fiscal restraint.
It was about deficit reduction and fiscal issues.
Yeah.
And Mitt said, you know, I agree with them on those issues. I can talk about deficit reduction with the Tea Party crowds, right? And
so he totally misreads this.
He misread the moment.
Yeah.
He misread what was happening in the country. He misread what was happening to his party. And one of his advisors, his chief political strategist, Stuart Stevens, was a little more clear-eyed about what was going on. And at one point told him, once they were kind of all in running, he said, look, I think you'll be a great president, and that's why I'm working for you. But you have to understand, the base of your party is Southern and evangelical and conservative, and you're a Massachusetts moderate Mormon. And so if we're going to win this nomination, we're going to have to steal it. That was the argument that Stuart Stevens made, and I think that basically proved true.
So his father has this gaffe that knocks him out of the out of contention, and ironically, Mitt Romney also has a gaffe that I wanted to ask you about, because you mentioned in the book how, you know, part of the game you play in presidential politics is you show up to these closed door fundraisers. You mentioned Stuart Stevens, and Stevens, you said, had been sort of begging him, all right, when you go to these things, stop taking questions. It's a bad idea. But in September of this, I guess it's 2012 when this plays out, in September of 2012, late in the season, the story breaks out that one of these Q&As, it's a secret video. The magazine Mother Jones gets its hands on it. And this is where, of course, Mitt Romney describes the 47% of the people who will vote for Barack Obama no matter what. People, he said, who believe, you know, that the government has a responsibility to care for them, who believe they're entitled to food and housing and health care. And I think what's really extraordinary, and I hadn't seen any reporting about this, is the way he's reacting in private, because he seems to go into, you write, McKay, full-on, some people even thought clinical depression over this.
Yeah. This was one of the big revelations to me from reading his journals from the 2012 campaign. The entries in the weeks after the 47% comments leak are really kind of agonized. Like, he couldn't believe he had made this mistake. He couldn't believe that he was going to let so many people down. He had convinced himself he was going to lose the election no matter what now. And he just beats himself up night after night. He would get on his iPad and type out his journal for that day, and he would just call himself stupid, and he would kind of lean into or lay into how, you know, how could I have made this mistake? You know, part of it, I think, was that he knew he was repeating the cycle that his father had, right? And after spending so much of his political career trying to avoid that one mistake that his dad had made, he was now making the same one. You know, at one point it got so bad that he called Stuart Stevens, his strategist, late one night and said, I think I need to drop out of the race. Wow. And this is after he had won the nomination. Mm-hmm. This is 6 weeks until the election.
Yeah.
He says, I need to drop out, get Chris Christie or someone to take my place. It speaks to how crushing that moment was for him.
Mm.
But, you know, also how seriously he took, you know, his responsibilities, right? You know, I should say, I asked him a couple different times about those comments and why he said those things. Because, you know, in his journal, he writes, you know, this is the exact opposite of what I believe. Like, I'm not running for president to help the comfortable and well off. Like, I want to help those 47% of people. I want to help the people who are struggling economically. I think I have the ability to turn things around, you know, and that's why I'm running. And he said, look, sometimes you're on the campaign trail and a donor asks you a question and it's a dumb question and you're exhausted and cranky and you accept the premise of the question. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what happened there. But eventually, Ann and Stuart Stevens and his family kind of talked him off the ledge and said, you're going to finish the campaign. You've got to, you know, do everything you can. And, he did eventually kind of pull out of that depression, and he decided to throw himself into debate prep and do everything he could to win the race. And, he staged a comeback. Ultimately, it wasn't enough. But I thought it was fascinating just how anguished he was by that 47% video coming out. It was one of the more revelatory things I learned in my reporting.
You write about this moment from when he loses, Mitt Romney, of course, the 2012 election. And I'm not sure I remember this moment, but this is Donald Trump on election night, sitting, as you say, in the dark of a helicopter above Boston, because he's thinking he might go and help celebrate Donald Trump now with Mitt Romney. And he is, it's such a strange moment. He starts sending these tweets saying that the election was stolen, that we can't let this happen. We should march on Washington. Our nation is totally divided. What a weird parallel moment this was.
It's funny that you say you don't remember that. I didn't remember that either. I think very few people remember that moment from 2012 election night, because at that time, people didn't really take Donald Trump seriously. People weren't paying attention to what Donald Trump tweeted on election night because he seemed like a gadfly. In hindsight, you could see the seeds of, you know, the next 10 years, basically, and how our politics have been shaped by the refusal to accept an election loss. I do think it's worth noting that on election night, in the hotel suite where Mitt Romney was gathered with his family and advisors, there were some people who pointed out, you know, some of these swing states are pretty close. Maybe we shouldn't concede. Maybe we should fight, you know, bring some lawyers in and see what we can do. And Mitt actually said, no, we're not going to do that. I don't want to look like a nut job, and we need to move on. And so he went out and gave his kind of brief, gracious concession speech like every loser of a presidential campaign had in for, you know, hundreds of years. But, you know, there was a kind of fork in the road there where he could have followed the path that Donald Trump eventually did, and he chose not to.
Let's talk about Mitt Romney's relationship with Donald Trump. We know what it is today, but what did he used to think about Donald Trump? You say in some ways he kind of, I mean, he never took him seriously, it sounds like, but he kind of thought he was, if not charming, kind of amusing. Is that right?
He kind of liked him. I mean, there's an interesting journal entry from Romney's 2012 campaign where he writes that, he had just gotten off the phone with Trump and, it was ridiculous and entertaining and outlandish, and that Romney found that it had actually lifted his spirits. He said something like, you know, they just don't make him like Donald Trump anymore. He never really took Trump seriously. Mm. He always saw him as a sort of cartoon character of a businessman whose, you know, fortune had been made through basically inheritance and luck. But he also, because he didn't take him seriously, he didn't think there was that much risk in kind of cozying up to him. Yeah. In that 2012 campaign, he famously stood on a stage at the Las Vegas Trump Hotel and accepted Donald Trump's endorsement for president. Mm-hmm. And at the time, Donald Trump was talking about how Barack Obama wasn't really born in the United States and was floating all kinds of outlandish conspiracy theories that many regarded as racist. And, you know, Romney thought all that stuff was nonsense. And he at first didn't want to accept Trump's endorsement because he thought it would make him look dumb. But he was basically convinced by his consultants that, you know, this was important to do to win the primary. And so he went along with it. Mm. But his rationalization at the time was basically, look, Barack Obama gets to, you know, be endorsed by all kinds of weird celebrities, right?
Yeah.
Like, if he can take Kanye West's endorsement, why can't I take Donald Trump's? It's not until now, in hindsight, that he sees that was sort of the beginning of Donald Trump's political rise. And he, you know, he did tell me that if he did anything to give him political credibility, he obviously regrets it now.
Talk about McCabe when he realizes what he sees as the danger of someone like of Donald Trump. And it kind of gets us to this speech that he gives at the Libby Gardner Concert Hall here on the campus of the University of Utah, where Romney, of course, memorably calls Trump a phony and a fraud. Set us up for what's happening here and the way he thinks about the import, I guess, of this speech that he's thinking of giving before he gives it, I guess.
Well, you know, for the first few months of Donald Trump's campaign, Romney just assumed he would flame out. But once Trump won the first couple of primaries and it looked like he was on a glide path to the nomination, Romney became very alarmed. And the straw that broke the camel's back was this interview that Trump gave to CNN, yeah, where he was asked what he thought of David Duke, who was the leader of the Ku Klux Klan, endorsing his candidacy. And Trump basically refused to condemn David Duke. He said, I don't know anything about David Duke. I don't know what you're even talking about with white supremacy. I don't know. Did he endorse me? What's going on? He basically kind of played dumb. And to Romney, that was a clear case of Trump flirting with white supremacy and courting the vote of overt white nationalists. And for Romney, whose dad had been this kind of civil rights, pro-civil rights governor, he just couldn't abide it anymore. So he decided to give this speech at the University of Utah. He wrote the speech himself.
Mm-hmm.
What I think is most fascinating is that he, at the end of the speech, lays out this pretty audacious plan that he gets behind, which is every reasonable Republican needs to band together now to stop Trump from winning this nomination. And so what he called for was the remaining campaigns in the primary to coordinate with each other to ensure that Trump didn't win enough delegates to clinch the nomination, and instead that the convention would go to Cleveland, and that basically the nominee would be picked from the convention floor. That hasn't happened in a very long time in political history, but Romney believed it was the only way at that point to stop Trump. And what I didn't know until I started doing the reporting on this book and I started going through the emails that he gave me. He gave me this huge trove of emails and with various Republicans over the years, is that Romney actually worked pretty aggressively behind the scenes to stop Trump from clinching the nomination, to make this happen in a way that I think few people understood at the time.
Well, so Romney had written in his journal that Texas Senator Ted Cruz was scary and a demagogue, yet he tries to create a ticket with Cruz as the nominee and Marco Rubio as VP. I mean, that's how that was an interesting twist.
Well, I mean, I think that shows just how frightening he found Donald Trump, right? He did not like Ted Cruz and still, I think, doesn't like him. But he, you know, compared to Donald Trump, he thought at least Ted Cruz somewhat operates within the bounds of normal politics, even though he takes a lot of positions I don't like and I don't like his style. He still thought there was no question that Cruz would be a better president than Trump. And so, he tried to broker this unity ticket between Rubio and Cruz. He tried to convince John Kasich to drop out of the race because he was splitting the anti-Trump vote in the primaries. And every time he would kind of, float these ideas, they would sort of act like they understood where he was coming from. They might even act like they agreed. Rubio and Cruz both said that they were open to a unity ticket. But then days would go by and nothing happened. And the campaigns weren't talking to each other. And the candidates weren't talking to each other. And with every week that went by, Trump was winning more and more delegates while the rest of the party was sort of, floundering. And it drove Romney crazy. I mean, reading his journals from this period, he just gets more and more frustrated with the fecklessness of the party establishment with the selfishness of these candidates. He's been talking to all of these candidates at this point about Donald Trump, and he knows that they think he's a menace, that they think it would be cataclysmic for the country if he was elected president. Mm. But when he asks them to even just temporarily suspend their short-term political self-interest for the good of the country, they balk. They're not willing to do it. And, you know, he, over time, I think that really radicalized him in a way.
It's interesting. There's this, when he was considering whether to run for Senate, you say that he had typed out this line from Yates that he couldn't get out of his head. Do you want to talk a little bit about that? Because one of the things you've mentioned is how, I guess, how mystified Mitt Romney was about the, how did you put it, the psychic allure for people in power, particularly in the Senate that he was seeing, for just wanting to stay there.
So that that line from Yates that he wrote as he was typing out his pros and cons list of whether he should run for Senate in Utah, it's from the famous poem, The Second Coming, and it says, the best lack all conviction while the worst are full of passionate intensity. And Romney believed that that captured what was happening to the Republican Party under Trump. He believed there were still a lot of good, decent people in the party, but that they were scared, right? They had basically been cowed into silence because they didn't want to lose their seats. They didn't want to lose re-election by crossing Trump. Meanwhile, the worst elements of the party, the kind of overtly racist elements, the people who were xenophobes or, you know, just wanted to burn everything down, they were emboldened by Trump and they were becoming more powerful and more visible. And Romney believed when he entered the Senate that he could be a voice for the best among his party. But as you alluded to, once he got to the Senate, he realized that that ran directly in contradiction to the psychology of his caucus. He told me his insights into how the Senate works and kind of how its members think were really interesting to me. He said, the Senate is essentially a club for old men. You know, there's all these senators who are in their 60s, 70s, even 80s, who they don't need the government salary, right? Yeah. They don't need the job, but they need the power. They need the sense of relevance and the staff and the fancy office and the invitations to the important events. And for a lot of them, you know, they've tried retirement. They've had success in the private sector or elsewhere in their lives, and they tried to retire and they were bored and stir crazy. And so now they cling to their Senate seats. It's almost like losing re-election would be like dying for a lot of them. And Romney wasn't aware when he entered the Senate just how much psychic currency his colleagues attached to their seats. And once he realized it, he realized it was going to be very hard for him to get to kind of rally a significant portion of Republican senators to speak out against what was happening to their party, even though he knew that they agreed with him because they often said so in private.
There's a story you tell in the book. In fact, you lead with it, which brings us to January 6th, of course. But it really begins a few days earlier when Romney gets this text message from Senator Angus King of Maine. Will you tell us this story?
Yeah. So on January 2nd, he gets a text from Angus King, who's the junior senator from Maine. Says, could you give me a call when you get a chance? Important. So he calls King, and King tells him that he just got off the phone with a high-ranking Pentagon official and that they've been tracking online chatter from conservative extremists who appear to be planning, something very bad on January 6th. That was the day Donald Trump was holding this big rally in Washington, D.C. He had been saying that the election was stolen, that they needed to steal it back. And what Angus King had heard was that people were talking about bringing guns and bombs into D.C. There was talk of arson. And Romney's name had been popping up in a lot of these conversations as a potential target. And so Angus King basically just wanted to warn him, you know, this could get bad. So Romney, after getting off the phone, sends a text message to Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader. And I'll just read you the text, because this is one of the first things Romney showed me, actually, when we started working on this. This is the text he sent to McConnell. It says, "In case you have not heard this, I just got a call from Angus King, who said that he had spoken with a senior official at Pentagon who reports that they are seeing very disturbing social media traffic regarding the protests planned on the 6th. There are calls to burn down your home, Mitch, to smuggle guns into D.C., and to storm the Capitol. I hope that sufficient security plans are in place, but I am concerned that the instigator, the president, is the one who commands the reinforcements the D.C. and Capitol Police might require." McConnell never responded to this text. And, of course, 4 days later, we found out that it was prophetic.
McConnell never responds. I mean, that's the line that you include in the book after that text. And it just sits there. Have you ever talked to McConnell, or has Romney ever discussed what he thought about the idea of Mitch McConnell not responding to such a dire text?
McConnell disputed a couple of Romney's characterizations of conversations that they had that I recount in the book.
Yeah.
He did not dispute this, but he didn't offer any kind of defense. Romney, it's interesting. When you talk to Romney, even today, years later, about what happened on January 6th, he gets viscerally angry about the lies that were being told about his Senate colleagues who went along with Donald Trump's election lie, but also about how unprepared Congress was for this scenario, especially when Romney had explicitly warned McConnell of this scenario a few days earlier. You know, he tells me a story about when the senators were evacuated from the chamber on January 6th, the Capitol Police didn't know where to take them. There was no plan in place for, you know, a safe room, or this is the route we take to get to the basement or whatever. In fact, they at one point, a bunch of senators were just loitering around outside elevators, waiting to pile onto these elevators while the mob was inside the building. And Romney just found himself thinking, how are we so disorganized? How are we so unprepared? I told Mitch this, right? And so, you know, Romney is reluctant to blame this on Mitch McConnell, blame, you know, what happened on January 6th or you know, or anything that happened subsequently. But I could tell he was very frustrated with the fact that his warning went unheeded. And I think that's why he showed me that text in one of our very first meetings.
Well, there's an interesting moment, too, during all of this is playing out. You write that something about the volatility of the moment causes Romney to, here's how you put it, lose his grip, and he vents this raw primal anger that he's sort of spent his life trying to control and contain, screams at Senator Josh Hawley. You mentioned that. But more importantly, I thought anyway, in this story, was that you write that what Romney doesn't pause to consider in this moment is an uncomfortable question, and that is any of this my fault too? What do you mean?
Well, I think that over the 2 years we spend together, that was sort of the question hovering above all the conversations, right? Romney was very open with me about the moments in his life where he engaged in self-justification, when he indulged the more extreme elements of his party to win elections. And I think to a certain extent, he accepts some responsibility as one of many establishment mainstream Republicans for not understanding how dangerous those extremist forces were and not doing more to counter them earlier in his career. At the same time, I think he also, and this was one of a subject of kind of more than one heated conversation between the two of us. I think he also struggles with the idea that some have advanced that it's his fault that Donald Trump became president, right? Huh. That somehow his accepting Trump's endorsement in 2012 legitimized him as a political figure. Romney just, as a matter of analysis, just disagrees with that. He thinks that Trump rode a kind of once-in-a-generation populist wave into the White House that he would have ridden with or without Mitt Romney. But, you know, I think also he feels like there have been so few Republicans willing to do anything to counter Trump's corrosive effect on the country, and that he was one of them. And so I think he has a hard time accepting this idea that he should be saddled with the blame for it, when he you know, certainly regrets some of the ways he handled Trump, but ultimately feels like he's done more than almost anyone else in his party to push back.
You write something in the book, almost in passing, that I have to ask you about. You mentioned this time before Romney decides to run for Senate. He's looking for a project to keep himself busy. You know, he's bored. And you mentioned that M. Russell Ballard of the LDS Church, he's an apostle with the church, asked him to establish this this Mormon counterpart to the Jewish Anti-Defamation League. You don't say a whole lot about that, but what do you know about that idea?
I mean, so this was in the wake of the 2012 election, and,
yeah.
And you know, obviously a lot of the discussion of and coverage of Mormonism in the context of Romney's two presidential campaigns, you know, was not the most enlightened or the most sensitive. You know, the country was learning about Mitt Romney's faith in real time. There were some, you know, ugly things that were said. And I think after that election, you know, according to Romney's journals, Elder Ballard had this idea that maybe the church or some church adjacent entity needed to form an organization that would monitor and push back against anti-Mormon rhetoric or whatever.
Yeah.
Romney looked into it. He considered it, ultimately concluded that he didn't want to take on this project, and actually wasn't sure the project would help address the most pressing concerns he had for the church's future. He said that, you know, the biggest problem the church faces now is not, you know, misinformation or discrimination from outsiders, but it was retaining young people, you know, promoting faith in a secular world, and addressing some of the, you know, more difficult chapters of the church's history. Romney said, in other words, we have met the enemy and it was us.
Yeah.
I thought that was actually a pretty interesting insight. I mean, Mitt Romney cares a lot about his faith. He cares a lot about the church. But he's basically of the view that the biggest threat to the church is from within, and that as a people, we need to focus on ourselves and not what people outside of the church are saying about us. I thought that was a pretty interesting insight.
Did you get any sense, we don't need to belabor this, but did you get any sense if he believed, you mentioned that he thought the church needs to kind of deal with what he described as the prickly issues, or what you described as the prickly issues of church history that needed to be addressed. Did you talk much about that? I don't know if you want to say, but did he himself believe some of these issues needed to be? He's clearly an Orthodox Latter-day Saint. Let's stipulate that. But I just wondered what it was that he was seeing and the challenges for the church in the, you know, 21st century that he kind of could relate to, if that makes sense.
You know, I don't want to speak for him totally. I mean, I will say I write in the book about his own his father's experience being out of step with the church's position on racial issues in the 60s.
Yeah.
And you know, Mitt Romney's kind of own journey with that. I actually I include a story about.
Oh, tell it, will you? This is a great story. Let me set it up for you, because I think it's really. This is a story. You mentioned that when Senator Romney decides to vote for President Biden's Supreme Court selection, Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson, that he's motivated in part by this, you know, his church's history with black people. And you tell this story about him being in the Salt Lake Mission Home. This was in 1966. He's a young missionary, you know, in training. And a Mormon apostle, a lot of people who are listening to us now will know the name, Bruce R. McConkie, had told them, and I'll quote you here, not to preach the gospel to Negroes. And this prompts a question from Romney to the church leader. Tell the story.
Yeah, so a young Elder Romney was sitting next to another missionary who was from the South and seemed a little too enthusiastic about this policy in Romney's mind.
Yeah.
And it was agitating him. And so Romney kind of righteously raises his hand and asks Elder McConkie, well, we believe all people are equal, right? And it was kind of as a corrective to this other missionary. Mm. And according to Romney's recollection, Elder McConkie kind of glared at him from the podium and said, do you think you're equal to Jesus Christ? Do you think you're equal to Joseph Smith? And as Romney tells it, he kind of sunk quietly into his seat and decided not to get into a theological debate with an apostle that day. But he actually, in the decades since, had kind of mold how he should have responded to that, because it bothered him that he didn't give a better answer. And he told me, I wish I would have said, yes, we are all equal. Mm. We can all achieve the highest level of glory. And you know, Romney's own father had obviously been adamant throughout the 60s that the church would eventually lift its ban on priesthood and temple blessings for Black members. Anyway, all of this history sort of motivated Mitt later in life as he was considering whether to vote for the first Black woman on the Supreme Court. He said, you know, I was looking for a reason to support her. I know that she's going to have a lot of decisions on the bench that I disagree with, but given our church's history, I didn't want to be on the record opposing this kind of historic milestone.
What is the interest to the book told you about the current media and political environment? I mean, you are interested in this psychological reckoning over power that Mitt Romney's working through. And everyone else, sorry, many anyway, are paying attention to all the burns, you know, because there's a lot of burns. Newt Gingrich, a smug know-it-all, Mike Huckabee, a huckster, Bobby Jindal, a twit. But everyone's paying so much attention to that. Do you worry they're not paying attention to the theme of the book?
Yeah, I mean, what happened is that as these things always take place, like a bunch of, you know, little bits and pieces of the book leaked out in the press before the book was out. And literally the New York Times ran a piece entitled Mitt Romney's Sickest Burns in New Biography or something like that.
Yeah.
And, you know, look, I understand that's just the reality of our political media environment. I do hope people will buy the book and read it, if only to see the context of some of those comments. Some of those comments came from his journals years ago that he thought would be private. He eventually gave me his journals without having reread them. Mm-hmm. And I think he was taken aback by just how much material he gave me. And then, you know, some of the comments were things that he said to me more recently. I think if you read the book, you'll see that at the root of all those comments is a deep disappointment with the leadership of his party, as he has seen the GOP give up what Romney thought were the defining tenets of modern American republicanism and acquiesce around this cult of personality with Donald Trump. But also a kind of growing alarm with the state of American democracy. Again, I mean, Mitt sees this. I think that Mitt wanted to cooperate with me because he wanted to offer a warning to the country, right? He had seen the inside of American politics, the inside of the Senate, and he had seen a lot of things that worried him. And you know, he believes, as he told me in one of our first meetings, that authoritarianism is like the gargoyle hulking over the cathedral, ready to pounce, and he is not sure that the cathedral will hold, and he thinks it's time for us as a country to have a very difficult conversation about what we care about most. Do we care about pluralism in our society? Do we care about American democracy? Or do we care about our side winning and, you know, defeating the people we've decided are bad guys in American life? And those comments, I think, when you read the book, are in service to those broader themes that that I think are really important and I hope people will spend some time with.
Let me ask you finally, you end the book by telling about a visit you made to Romney's lake house where he gathers his family every year. And you had asked Romney this question when you first met, you say in the book, that he tells you when you're visiting that he's been thinking a lot about this question. And you had asked him if there were any lessons in his story for future political leaders. And one of the things he said was, he said the key was getting political leaders to think more deeply about how they'll be remembered when they're gone. What does he mean by that?
His argument is basically that if you're going through day-to-day life as an elected official, a politician, only thinking about your short-term political interests, you will rationalize all manner of bad behavior, right? You can convince yourself to do anything. You can talk yourself into crossing any line if the only consideration is whether you'll win re-election, whether you'll be able to hold on to your Senate seat or governorship or whatever. But if you start to think about how your obituary will be written, if you start thinking about how your kids and grandkids and great-grandkids will remember you, the calculus changes, right? The way that you comport yourself as an elected official will change because you want to be remembered well. You want to, you're thinking about your place in history. And, you know, Romney said, it's easy for me to say this now because I'm in my 70s, right? And so naturally I'm thinking about my place in history. The trick is to get people to think about their place in history when they're still young and feel immortal. And, you know, in his mind, one of the things that can do that is family, you know, cultivating a relationship, a real relationship with your spouse and your children, grandchildren. It's a reminder that when you're gone, there will be people who are left on earth with stories to tell about you. And you want those stories to be good ones. You know, I'll go back to this. When I first approached him about writing this book, He said he was, you know, going back and forth on whether to cooperate with me. He had kind of ruled out writing a memoir himself because for a number of reasons, including that he felt he couldn't be objective about his own life. He did say, I want something to give to my grandkids. I want this story of my life, and especially I think these last 10 years, to be written down somewhere so that my grandkids, my posterity has it. And the fact that he cares so much about that, I think, is ultimately a big reason that he agreed to go through this pretty difficult process. I mean, I will say, I think he's probably lost some relationships over the things that he's told me in this book. And I think, you know, if nothing else, it probably closed the door to another run for re-election in the Senate in Utah. But, you know, he cares much more about what his posterity will think of him. And I think there's something hopeful about that.
McKay Coppins, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
McKay Coppins, he's a staff writer for The Atlantic Magazine. His new book is Romney, A Reckoning. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love to hear from you if you have suggestions or ideas. Email us at radiowest@kuer.org. Our intern is Elle Cowley, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.